It's interesting how God prepares us ahead of time for the situations he wants to use us in. If you would have told me a year ago that I'd be speaking to you all today, I wouldn't have believed you. I would prefer to hide back in that room there where Chez is and be behind the scenes, but here we are, so we're going to make the best of it. When Chuck asked me to speak, I was a bit surprised that he asked, but I already had a vague idea of what I was supposed to talk about. The truth is that the last year has been a time of spiritual growth for me. Started a little over a year ago when I came to a point when I realized I had to figure out if what I believed really was the truth. It was through talking with a friend that I realized that I knew what I believed, but didn't know where exactly the Bible pointed to this. A lot of my unsettled thoughts came around the area of not knowing how to respond to contemporary forms of Christianity that either undermine the power of God or the validity of the Bible. I struggled with the fact of how we, as the church in general, can read the same Bible that we have always had and take it to mean something completely different than we did 50 years ago. If truth is truth, what's happening? It posed this question in my mind. Is our primary guide on how to live the Christian life still God and his word? Or are we looking to the world and culture to determine how we should live a life that glorifies God? It's one thing to have faith in a God that sounds good, is easy to understand, and maybe even predict. But it's a whole other thing to have faith in a God that goes beyond our understanding, that doesn't fit inside the box of human rationality. It's one thing to have faith that wears a mask of positivity, thinking that by sheer grit and willpower, we can make it through the struggles of life. It's another thing to have faith anchored in the Bible, which is our bedrock of truth, that holds us steady through the storms of life, relying on his grace for each day and not our own willpower. It's one thing to have a faith that puts me, my wants, my needs at the center of the universe and gives God the job of a vending machine. It's a whole other thing to have faith that bows its will and its life before the holy, powerful creator of everything, seeking to live in a way that makes him visible to all. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with being positive or asking God for things. I'm saying if our view of God is small and weak, it will only lead to problems down the road when hard times come. One book that I found particularly helpful during this time was a book by J.D. Greer titled Not God Enough: Why Your Small God Leads to Big Problems. Several of the ideas I present today are discussed in this book, and I would recommend it to anyone looking to dig into the same issue more. Through reading this book by J.D. as well as books on by others, and through digging deeper into the Bible, the area that seemed to single-handedly answer much of my previous unsettled thoughts was simply the glory of God. Both God displaying his own glory, as well as him seeking that we display his glory in our lives. This is his primary purpose in all he has done since the beginning of time and still does today. We look in Isaiah 43:7, and it shows God's purpose in creating man is to bring glory to himself. Psalm 19 says that the heavens declare the glory of God. 1 Corinthians 10:31 says, whatever you do, whether you do it all for the glory of God. Matthew 5:16 says, in the same way, let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father who is in heaven. You may ask, doesn't that make God selfish and egocentric if his primary purpose in all he does is to get praised? If we think about it and look at it through the fact or through the lens of what we know about ourselves, it's easy to see how we would end up there. But the truth is that God is nothing like us. His very nature is incapable of wrong. James 1:13 tells us God cannot be tempted, nor does he tempt. He can do no wrong. It is outside of his character. I want to say that what is said here this morning is, first of all, a challenge to myself personally before it is meant to be a challenge to any of you. The challenge to see God accurately and to make the truth of his greatness and glory visible in my life is something I fail at continually. I'm not claiming to have all the answers. I just want to share with you what God has been showing me. Now let's get to our passage. Today's passage is out of Exodus, and it comes right after the Israelites were freed from their 430 years of slavery in Egypt. God sends the 10 plagues on the people of Egypt, and each time Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he would not let the Israelites go. Then after the final plague, which was the death of the firstborn, Pharaoh finally agreed to let the people go to the wilderness to worship the Lord. And so the people left in haste. The Lord went before them by day in the form of a pillar of cloud and by night in the form of a fire. So let's pick up in chapter 14, verse 1 here. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp near Pi Hadroth, between Migdol and the sea. They are to encamp by the sea directly opposite Baal Zephon. Pharaoh will think the Israelites are wandering around in the land in confusion, hemmed in by the desert. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them. But I will gain glory for myself through Pharaoh and his army, and all the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord." So the Israelites did this. The Israelites had seen God harden Pharaoh's heart several times earlier. Each time a new plague was unleashed, God chose to harden Pharaoh's heart. It's interesting how God leads the Israelites in a manner that makes it appear as though they were wandering in confusion. When we choose to follow God, he may not lead us in the path of shortest distance between two points. He may choose to teach us some valuable lessons along the way, which may require some undesired detours. The Lord promises that even though Pharaoh's heart will be hardened again, that through it the Lord will bring himself glory. What does it mean for God to bring glory to himself? John Piper, in an article entitled "Rebuilding the Basics, the Centrality of God's Glory," he writes, "The glory of God is the holiness of God put on display and the infinite worth of God demonstrated." God desires to make his glory known through us as Christians who choose to lay our lives before him. However, he can also use even the hardened heart of Pharaoh to bring about his glory. Let's keep reading in verse 5. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds about them, and they said, "What have we done? We have let the Israelites go and have lost their services." So he had his chariot made ready and took his army with him. He took 600 of the best chariots along with all the other chariots of Egypt and with officers over all of them. Then the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, king of Egypt, so that he pursued the Israelites who were marching out boldly. I wonder what was going through the Israelites' minds right now. They were marching out boldly. Kind of sounds like they're confident in what they're doing, like they know what they're doing, like they know what the future holds, maybe. All they had known for their entire lives had been Egyptian slavery, and now they were free. They had seen God move in mighty ways as he poured out plagues on the Egyptians. They had seen God even kill the firstborn of both man and beast in all of Egypt. Earlier in Exodus 2, it says that by God's provision, they had gained favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And when the Israelites left in haste, fleeing Egypt that they asked the Egyptians for articles of gold, silver, and clothing. And the Egyptians gave freely without hesitation. Not only were they leaving with their pockets full of gold and silver from the Egyptians, but God was now leading them by a pillar of cloud by day and fire by night. If I could guess, I would imagine they felt pretty secure in their outlook on the future. Let's continue in verse 9. The Egyptians, all Pharaoh's horses, chariots, and horsemen and troops, pursued the Israelites and overtook them as they camped near Pi Heroth, opposite Baal Zephon. As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us, bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, 'Leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians'? We would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert." How often do we find that it feels easier and safer to let the fear keep us where we are, even if it is captive to slavery, as they were in Israel? In our lives, it feels safer for us to hold on to the illusion of control. And that's what it is. It is just an illusion. We are never really in control of our circumstances. It's easier to hang on to that illusion than it is to step into uncertainty and lay our lives before the Lord and ask that He uses us for His glory. All the Israelites knew in their life was slavery. Although it was bondage, they felt comfortable in it. Continuing in verse 13, Moses answered the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance of the Lord He will bring you today." How many of us know all too well that God does not step in exactly when we want Him to? Here it says, "We will see the deliverance of the Lord today." But oftentimes when we feel we need deliverance, it is what we would call is too late. Our ways are not God's ways, and our times are not His. If God doesn't always step in instantly, as He does here, doesn't that make Him seem weak and therefore bring less glory to Himself? Let's look at John 11. Here we have the account of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead. Mary and Martha sent word to Jesus that Lazarus was sick. Jesus waited to go until He knew that Lazarus had been dead for 4 days. Picking up in verse 4, it says, "When He heard this, Jesus said, 'This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it.'" Let's go back to Exodus, back to verse 14. It says here, "The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only be still." This is how the Lord is glorified. The Lord caused the Israelites to wander about in a way that made them look foolish in the eyes of Pharaoh. The Lord put the Israelites in a situation that they were not able to get out of on their own strength. To be still while an army of chariots is pursuing you seems pretty foolish by the world's standards. But that's what God asks them to do. How often does God ask us to do things that don't make sense, but still bring Him glory in the end, even if it is foolishness by the world's standards? In doing all this, God opened the opportunity to make His power known in a very tangible way. God's purpose in our struggle is rarely to remove us from our struggle, but to show Himself powerful and mighty in and through our struggles. And verse 15, When the Lord said to Moses, "Why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to move on. Raise your staff, stretch out your hand over the sea, divide the water so that the Israelites can go through on dry ground. I will harden the heart of the Egyptians so that they will go after them. I will gain glory through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and through his horsemen. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I gain glory through Pharaoh and his chariots and horsemen." So just how fundamental is it, this idea of God seeking his glory in all he does, and it being our purpose in everything we do? 1 Corinthians 10:31 says, "Whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God." Isaiah 43:7 says that all things were created for God's glory. Psalm 96 says we are to declare his glory among the nations. Ezekiel 39:21 says, "I will display my glory among the nations, that my people will know that I am the Lord their God." 1 Thessalonians 2:12 says, "Live lives worthy of the one who calls you into his kingdom and his glory." God's glory is not just to be our what we seek, it is to be our hope for the future. Romans 5:2, it says, "We rejoice in the hope of the glory of God." Titus 2:13, it says, "We wait for our blessed hope, that is the appearing of the glory of God." And Jesus says in John 17:24, says, "Father, I desire that they may see, that they may be with me where I am to see my glory." Isaiah 29:13. The Lord says, speaking to the Israelites, "These people come near to me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. Their worship of me is based on merely human rules that they have been taught." This word honor that's used here in this verse is the same Hebrew word as glorify, used in Exodus passage, but was translated into a different English word. God doesn't just want us to go through the motions of making it look like we are bringing him glory. He wants us to have the right heart attitude as well. If we are honest as humans, we tend to naturally be lovers of ourselves rather than lovers of God, as it says in 2 Timothy 3, verse 2. We would rather make ourselves look good than allow God to get glory in our lives. Does everything that we say and do honor God and bring him glory? Or does it prop up our self-image? Certainly it is inevitable, as imperfect people, that we will fail. That we will fail often, but the Lord desires a right heart attitude. Charles Spurgeon used to say, "If you're going to be saved 100%. The most miserable person in the world is the half-committed Christian who is just enough into the world to be miserable in God and just enough into God that they are miserable in the world." So what does all this mean for you today if everything we do is to be for God's glory? No matter what it is that God is calling you to do, one thing is for sure: he wants to bring glory to himself. If you know that you are weak in the area that he's calling you to, that's all the better, because he will receive more glory through your weakness. God is in the business of using the weak. He used Moses in spite of his poor speaking skills. He used Gideon, who was the least of his family. And the list goes on. First step to allowing God to be glorified in our lives is to get off the throne of our own lives and acknowledge that we need to stop trying to control the outcome of our situations. the very act of stepping off the throne of our lives creates uncertainty, and that uncertainty shows us that we are not in control. It feels like uncertainty, but in reality, we are trading our illusion of certainty for our for His promises that He has made to us. Hebrews 13:5, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. The Western culture that we live in today celebrates self-sufficiency, discourages reliance on anything outside of ourselves. This is the exact opposite of God's plan for our lives, and He wants us to rely on Him in all things. Because of this fact, in God's upside-down economy, our weakness is surprisingly more of a blessing. We are already aware that we are not blank enough, good enough, whatever, to do that God calls us to do. So we default into relying on God right away instead of trying first on our own power. In your life today, God may be calling you to flee from the army. He may not be calling you to flee from an army of armed chariots, but He may be calling you to witness to a friend or neighbor or acquaintance. He may be calling you to stand up for what is right in the workplace. He may be calling you to talk to the stranger who looks hopeless. In all of this, is your certainty in God's promises, or is it in your hope of being in control?